This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with one of the most celebrated writers of our time, Toni Morrison. Morrison won a Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1988 for her novel Beloved, about a former slave looking back on her life after the Civil War. In 1993, she became the first African-American woman to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. In 2012, President Obama awarded Morrison the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. This year, she won the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Book Critics Circle. Morrison, who is now 84, has a new novel that's just been published called God Help the Child. It begins with the line, "It's not my fault." Those words are spoken by an African-American woman explaining that she has no idea why she gave birth to such a dark-skinned baby. The mother is embarrassed by her daughter's darkness and wants to distance herself. The daughter is scarred by not having her mother's love. The novel is about those childhood wounds that leave a lasting mark, even into adulthood.
Toni Morrison, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'd like to start by asking you to do a reading from your new novel. So this is from very early in the novel, where Sweetness, the mother, who is light-skinned African-American, is talking about how shocking and upsetting it was to give birth to a daughter with very dark skin. As she describes it, midnight black, Sudanese black. So would you pick up from there with the reading?
Sure. I hate to say it, but from the very beginning in the maternity ward, the baby, Lula Ann, embarrassed me. Her birth skin was pale, like all babies, even African ones, but it changed fast. I thought I was going crazy when she turned blue-black right before my eyes. I know I went crazy for a minute because once, just for a few seconds, I held a blanket over her face and pressed. But I couldn't do that, no matter how much I wished. She hadn't been born with that terrible color. I even thought of giving her away to an orphanage someplace. And I was scared to be one of those mothers who put their babies on church steps. Recently I heard about a couple in Germany, white as snow, who had a dark-skinned baby nobody could explain. Twins, I believe, one white, one colored. But I don't know if it's true. All I know is that for me, nursing her was like having a pickaninny sucking my teat. I went to bottle feeding soon as I got home. My husband, Louis, is a porter, and when he got back off the rails, he looked at me like I was really crazy and looked at her like she was from the planet Jupiter. He wasn't a cussing man, so when he said, "God damn, what the hell is this?" I knew we were in trouble. That's what did it, what caused the fights between me and him. It broke our marriage to pieces. We had 3 good years together. But when she was born, he blamed me and treated Lula Ann like she was a stranger. More than that, an enemy. He never touched her. I never did convince him that I ain't never, ever fooled around with another man. He was dead sure I was lying. We argued and argued till I told him her blackness must be from his own family, not mine.
That's Toni Morrison reading from her new novel, God Help the Child. So the mother distances herself from the daughter because of the daughter's dark skin. The father leaves thinking this child must not be his because he too is lighter skinned. And that sets the whole story in motion. And I'm wondering why you chose color, you know, the level of blackness as a central part of the story.
Well, I wanted to separate color from race. Distinguishing color, light, black, in between, as the marker for race is really an error. It's socially constructed. It's culturally enforced. and it has some advantages for certain people. But this is really skin privilege.
So were there times in your life when you've been exposed to that kind of hierarchy of color within the African-American community?
I have. I didn't have it until I went away to college. But I noticed, in addition to the outside world of Washington, D.C., which at that time, this is 1949, 1950, there were very obvious stated written differences between what white people were able to do and what black people were able to do. But on the campus where I felt safe and welcome, I began to realize that this idea of the lighter, the better, and the darker, the worse, had an impact on sororities, on friendships, on all sorts of things. And it was stunning to me.
There was a New York Times Magazine cover story about you recently. And in that article, you described when you were young, witnessing your father throw a white man down the stairs because your father thought this man was coming up the stairs after his daughters. Was your father afraid that this man was coming to abuse you and your sisters?
I think he thought so. So I think his own experience in Georgia would have made him think that any white man bumbling up the stairs toward our apartment was not there for any good. And since we were little girls, he assumed that. I think he made a mistake. I mean, I really think the man was drunk. I don't think he was really trailing us. But the interesting thing was, A, the white man was, he survived. B, the real thing for me was I felt profoundly protected and defended. I was not happy because after my father threw him down the steps all the way out into the street, he threw our tricycle after him. That was a little bit of a problem since we needed our tricycle. But that made me think that there was some deviltry, something evil about white people, which is exactly what my father thought. He was very, very serious in his hatred of white people. What mitigated it was my mother, who was exactly the opposite, who never rejected or accepted anybody based on race or color or religion or any of that. Everybody was an individual whom she approved of or disapproved of based on her perception of them as individuals.
It sounds, you said that this incident made you feel protected. It sounds terrifying, though, for two reasons. One is that your father basically gave you the idea that this man was coming upstairs to do you harm. And two, watching your father not only throw him down the stairs, but throwing your tricycle down the stairs after him, it sounds like that would be a little frightening to see also.
Well, if it was you and a black man was coming up the stairs after a little white girl and the white father threw the black man down, that wouldn't disturb you.
I'm trying to think that through. I guess, you know,
I think it's a product of
being in this, like, not very violent, working class, middle class family where I didn't see a lot of violence when I was growing up. So any violent act would probably have been very unnerving to me.
Well, it was my father who could do no wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't think of it as, oh, look, my father is a violent man. He never spanked us. He never quarreled with us. He never argued with us. He was dedicated and he was sweet. So he did this thing to protect his children. Now, I lived in a little working class town that had no black neighborhoods at all. one high school. We all played together. Everybody was either somebody from the South or an immigrant from East Europe or from Mexico. And we were all pretty much, until the end of the war, very, very poor. I'm not at all a person who has been reared or raised in a community in which these racial lines were that pronounced. Occasionally, as children, we might figure out how to call somebody a name, and they would figure out how to call us. But it wasn't, it was so light, it was so fluffy. I didn't really have a strong awareness of segregation and the separation of races until I left Lorain, Ohio.
You know, I'm thinking,
I thought the whole world was like Lorain.
I think it must have been hard for your father to hate white people and to live in a neighborhood in which there's a lot of white people.
Well, you know, my father saw two black men lynched on his street in Cartersville, Georgia, as a child. And I think seeing two black businessmen, not vagrants, hanging from trees as a child was traumatic for him.
My guest is Toni Morrison, and her new novel is called God Help the Child. You know, another theme in your book is how, you know, parents can mess up their children and how, as one character puts it, how childhood cuts festered and never scabbed over. And I know you're writing this as an older woman, but when you were younger and first became a parent, were you very worried that you'd mess up, that you'd do something that was unknowingly terribly wrong? I don't mean something as extreme as what happens to the characters here, but I think so many parents worry that they're going to inadvertently do something that scars their child.
I never worried about it when I had them, when I, lived among my family and then just myself and my children when they went to school. I never did think that I would hurt them in any way while it was going on. Afterwards, I remember every error, every word I spoke that was wrong or incontinent, every form of when I did not protect them properly. Now that I'm 84, I remember everything as a mistake. And I regret everything. Now, mind you, one of them is now deceased. One is very successful. So I don't have any reason for this except perhaps age and regret. But I always thought I was able and competent all the while I was rearing them.
Yeah, I want to say your younger son died of pancreatic cancer. I was very sorry to hear about that. That was a few years ago, and he was in his 40s.
Yes.
When he died. Why do you think later in life you started focusing on everything you thought you perhaps did wrong?
I guess I'm depressed. I don't know. But I can't explain it. Part of it is the irritability of being 84. And part of it is being not as physically strong as I once was. And part of it is my misunderstanding, I think, of what's going on in the world. And so writing for me is the big protection. But when I'm not creating or focusing on something I can imagine or invent, I think I go back over my life. I don't recommend this, by the way. And you pick up, oh, what'd you do that for? Why didn't you understand this? Not just with children as a parent, but with other people, with friends. So it's a long period of, it's not profound regret. It's just a wiping up of tiny little messes that you didn't recognize as mess when they were going on.
Well, this reminds me of a couple of lines from your novel that I want to read. And this is, you know, the main character, the woman who was born with very dark skin and grows into being, like, very, very beautiful and has her own cosmetics line and everything. At one point, I don't want to give away too much of the actual story, but at one point she's in an accident and breaks her foot, so she's kind of immobilized. And so she's thinking, helpless, idle. It became clear to Bride, Bride is her name, it became clear to Bride why boredom was so fought against. Without distraction or physical activity, the mind shuffled, pointless, scattered recollections around and around. And that strikes me as like what you're talking about. When you're not writing, when your mind is idle, that it just kind of goes through the shuffle of thoughts, in your case, negative thoughts, that you dwell on in a way that you'd prefer not to.
It's true. It's true. And then, you know, when you reach a certain age, you know, some very, very close friends of mine are dead, and others are far away. So you narrow down your acquaintances, the ones that mean a lot to you. I have my sister, who's a year and a half older, and of course my own son and grandchildren. But it gets you're in a smaller world, personally. And so there is this boredom or the absence of something to do. I mean, I don't work. I keep telling people I'm unemployed. And I don't wash dishes, and I don't wash clothes, and I don't clean my house. Somebody else does that. So there's this void. And I think you're absolutely right. What you pull, what you can pull, if you're an irritable old lady, into that void is every misstep, wrong word. Why didn't you visit? Why didn't you do this? You know, the opposite of that is when you get to a certain age and there's a void and you begin to remember every hurt somebody did to you. That never happens to me.
Why not? Because I kind of think you could hold both thoughts in your mind at the same time and run through all the hurt you've created while at the same time running through all the things that people have done to you that have hurt you. One does not preempt the other.
I think I'll start.
So you get around in a wheelchair now, and I'm not sure of why you need it, but I'm wondering if the limitation on your physical abilities also leaves more idle time for negative reflection.
Oh, and negative reflection and a floating anger, a back operation that worked for 8 months and doesn't work anymore. Oh. Do I go back or do I sit in a chair? Or, you know what I mean? So now that the weather is wonderful, I'm going to take my little walker and walk, which I haven't been able to do all winter. You know, there's something about being arthritic or backache or what the hell, whatever, that makes you feel put upon. You know, I remember my mother used to think if she lost her socks that they hated her.
That the socks hated her?
Yeah, of course.
So do you feel like your body hates you?
Yeah, right. I did so much for you, body. Why aren't you helping me now when I need you? I was so nice to you.
I know, but it's hard to make peace with your body when you feel like you're under attack with pain.
I do feel like I'm under attack. You know, it's a little way of dealing with it. I don't take painkillers. I sometimes take at night, but I don't have anything else that I do that some people do in order to avoid their pain or make it lower. I just have it. And I know that I cannot stand up for more than 6 minutes. And I cannot walk long distances. Now, of course, I have therapy. I have a therapist. I have this and that. And it helps a little bit for about 2 days. But you have to do that constantly, you know, to really keep in shape. And I have to admit, I have not been attentive to what the body should be doing or should be made to do as you grow older.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Toni Morrison. She has a new novel called God Help the Child. The main character's birth name is Lula Ann Bridewell. When she's 16, she changes it to Ann Bride. 2 years later, she changes it to one name, Bride. And she's in the fashion world, in the cosmetics world. So it's a very, you know, signature kind of name to have. Names are very important in your fiction. There's often people often have nicknames. And I'm interested in hearing about why names have such real and symbolic importance in your stories.
Well, there's a whole history, I think, in naming. In the beginning of black people being in this country, they lost their names. And they were given names by their masters. And so they didn't have names. And they began to call one another, you know, decades later, by nicknames. I don't think I knew any of my father's friends, male friends, by their real names. I remember them only by their nicknames. And also, there was a honesty sometimes. The names were humiliating, deliberately so. Somebody would pick out your flaw. If you were little, they would call you Shorty. And if you were angry, they would call you the devil. I remember a man in the neighborhood who was called Jim the Devil. Always those three words. Have you seen Jim the Devil? No. I saw. And then you think of the musicians. Satchmo, Louis Armstrong. What is Satchmo? That's Satchel Mouth. Or you think about them giving themselves royal names, Duke and Count and King. You know, it's a very personal identification, trying to move away maybe from the history of having no name and then personalizing it. On the one hand, to give you a name that's embarrassing in order to make you confront it, deal with it now. And then later on, more charming names, moving away from humiliating names like Satchmo.
So your birth name is Chloe Wofford. Morrison was your married name when you were married, but you've been divorced a long time, since 1974. And Toni was shortened from Anthony, which was the name when you were
baptized.
And so am I right in saying that you became a Catholic when you were 12? That's what I read.
Yeah, I did.
So let's start with your name. Once you started being called Toni, did you feel different from being called Chloe?
I never felt like anything other than Chloe. You know, my name, Chloe, nobody could pronounce it properly outside my family. In school, the teachers called me Chlo or Clovy or Chlory. Because it was spelled that way. It's much more common now. But I couldn't bear to have people mispronounce my name. But the person I was this person who was called Chloe. And then there's a wing of my family who are all Catholics. And one of them was a cousin with whom I was very close. And she was a Catholic. And so I got baptized, etc. And I chose St. Anthony of Padua as the baptismal name. So then I go away. And the people in Washington, they don't know how to pronounce C-H-L-O-E. So somebody mistakenly called me Tony because she couldn't hear Chloe. So I said, uh-huh. Now, so I don't care. Call me Tony. It's easy. You don't have to mispronounce my name. And then I meant to put my maiden name in the first book I wrote. As a matter of fact, I called the publisher and said, oh, by the way, I don't want Toni Morrison to be on the book. And they said, it's too late. They've already sent it to the Library of Congress. But I really would have preferred Toni Wofford.
So just one more question. You didn't start writing till you were 39 or 40. Is that because you didn't have the time or didn't know you had it in you? Like, what was the point in which you said, I'm going to write a novel? What changed?
When I was teaching at Howard University, after I got a master's at Cornell, I went to TSU and then I went back to Howard to teach. And I was young, in my 20s. And I joined a group of faculty and writers who met, I think, once a month to read to each other and critique each other. Some of them were professional writers, and some were not. And so I brought to these meetings little things I had written for classes as an undergraduate, some fiction, some not, and so on. And they had really, really good lunches, really good food during these meetings. But they wouldn't let you continue to come if you were just reading old stuff. So I had to think up something new if I was going to continue to have this really good food and really good company outside of my colleagues. So I started writing, and I remember very clearly I was writing with a pencil. I was sitting on the couch, writing with a pencil, trying to think up something and remembering what I just described. And tablet was that legal pad, you know, yellow with the lines. And I had a baby. My older son was barely walking. And he spit up on the tablet. And I was doing something really interesting, I think, with a sentence, because I wrote around the puke, because I figured I could always wipe that away, but I might not get that sentence again. So I wrote a bit of that. I went to the meetings. They thought it was very interesting. It was just, you know, maybe 5 or 6 pages, and they were very encouraging. And then I left and I went to Syracuse, et cetera, et cetera. And in the mornings before my children were awake, I would go back and finish that. And then it took 5 years, by the way, to write that little book, because I wasn't thinking about publishing. I was thinking about that narrative and what I wanted to say, you know. So that's really how I got started.
Toni Morrison's new novel is called God Help the Child. You can hear a longer version of her interview with Terry Gross on our podcast at iTunes.com/freshair. Ross McDonald is the third member of the unholy trinity of founding American hard-boiled detective fiction masters. The Library of America is publishing a collection of 4 of McDonald's 1950s novels, and book critic Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation.
Ross McDonald had a smart answer to the tedious question of why he devoted his considerable talents to writing mere detective stories. McDonald said that the detective story was a kind of welder's mask, enabling writers to handle dangerously hot material. Like Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, the great hard-boiled masters whom he revered, MacDonald set out to excavate the dark depths of American life. But to find his own dangerously hot material, MacDonald descended into uncharted territory. His hard-boiled predecessors had walked the mean streets of San Francisco and L.A. MacDonald moved to the suburbs, a California landscape of mortgage dreams that already seems exhausted in the four mystery novels of the 1950s reprinted in this Library of America collection. All those images of suburbia gone sour that distinguish the work of a John Cheever, Richard Ford, Tom Perata, or even the early seasons of Mad Men owe something to Ross MacDonald's penetrating vision. It took MacDonald a while to find his voice, as he himself explains in a couple of moody autobiographical essays that appear at the end of this collection. His hard-knock life story reads like something out of a James M. Cain Depression-era noir. MacDonald was born in California in 1915, but grew up in Canada. His father abandoned the family when MacDonald was four, and he and his mother bounced from relatives' homes to rooming houses. Like so many lonely kids before and after him, MacDonald escaped into reading, falling in love with the novels of Dickens and then, fatally, Hammett. Thanks to a life insurance policy payout upon the timely death of that absentee father, MacDonald went to college and then graduate school in English, the first of our hard-boiled masters to earn a Ph.D. If you look closely, you can spot the influence of the Romantic poets in MacDonald's quick and always surprising imagery. Take this phrase from his 1959 masterpiece, The Galton Case, where he characterizes a tough but naive dame as possessing an asphalt innocence. For a long time, MacDonald's wife, Margaret Miller, was the more successful mystery writer. MacDonald's own early novels sounded too much like Chandler knockoffs. But when he entered psychotherapy in 1956, MacDonald and his detective hero Lou Archer came into their own. You can hear the transformation in the opening pages of MacDonald's breakthrough 1958 novel, The Doomsters. A troubled young man bangs at Lou Archer's door in the wee hours of the morning. Archer tells us, "A pre-breakfast client was the last thing I needed that morning." But it was one of those times when you have to decide between your own convenience and the unknown quantity of another man's trouble. Sam Spade would have rolled over in bed and ignored the knock. Philip Marlowe would have been out walking the L.A. streets in the rain. Later on, Mickey Spillane would have just shot that annoying pre-dawn visitor. But Lou Archer is as much a social worker, a counselor, a father confessor, as he is a private eye. MacDonald gave us a detective with psychological depth, a gumshoe capable of throwing around words like gestalt. The four 1950s novels gathered in this Library of America volume offer readers the thrill of watching a writer evolve. I could urge you to read MacDonald because other great writers, from Eudora Welty to George Pelicanos, have paid him homage. I could make a sociological argument about how these novels offer a panoramic tour of 1950s California, a landscape of cars and beat poetry joints, here dismissively referred to as culture caves. But mostly, you should read MacDonald for the reason you read any great writer— for the thrill of the language and vision. I leave you with this passage from The Galton Case, where Archer describes his visit to a rich old woman who implores him to find her long-lost grandson. Mrs. Galton spoke like a little girl, betrayed by time and loss, by fading hair and wrinkles and the fear of death. She was chanting in a ritual of hope about being reunited with her grandson. If she said it often enough, it would come true. "I'm hungry," she said. "I want my lunch." That meditation on human yearning and mortality ends with the intrusion of something baser. MacDonald's encompassing awareness distinguishes his writing. He gives us the good, the bad, and the ugly. All the stuff that makes us human beings tick.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Ross Macdonald, Four Novels of the 1950s, from the Library of America. The new Fox television comedy series The Last Man on Earth was created by Will Forte, who also stars in the show as Phil, a man who at first believes he's the only human on Earth who survived a deadly virus.
Oh, you're just up there laughing at me, God, aren't you? Why did you do this?
The Last Man on Earth is about to wrap up its first season and already has been renewed for a second. Will Forte starred with Bruce Dern in the film Nebraska and was a cast member of Saturday Night Live from 2002 to 2010. One of his most famous characters on SNL was MacGruber, a parody of the main character in the TV series MacGyver, about a secret agent who was able to use everyday items to get out of dangerous situations. In this sketch, Kristen Wiig and Charles Barkley play MacGruber's assistants.
MacGruber, this door is magnet locked. We're trapped.
That's not our only problem, MacGruber. From the looks of that nitrogen bomb, we've only got 20 seconds.
Don't worry, Vicky. Chill, Durrell. We'll have plenty of time to relax, time to chill, Durrell, once we get out of here, once we scram, Durrell.
It's pronounced Daryl.
Oh, like a white Daryl.
10 seconds, MacGruber!
Okay, Vicky, hand me that Allen wrench.
You got it, MacGruber!
Okay, Durrell.
Daryl!
Funk me over to copper wire, out of sight.
It's Daryl.
Okay, Vicky, hand me that stir stick.
On the way, MacGruber!
Durrell.
It's Daryl!
Jazz me over that fly shoelace, you dig?
MacGruber, I don't know if this is working out.
That reminds me of a good joke. What do you get when you cross a Mexican with a black...
MacGruber.
Excuse me, a black African-American. Mo better?
Yeah, mo better.
Okay, so you cross a Mexican with a black African-American and a Jew and a woman, and what do you get? I don't know, but I sure don't want that person to move in next door to me.
We're going to hear the interview Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recently recorded with Will Forte. But first, let's listen to a scene from an early episode of The Last Man on Earth, in which Forte's character, Phil, finally finds another survivor, played by Kristen Schaal. Although they don't really like each other, they decide to get married since they believe they're the last two people on Earth. But just a few minutes after the ceremony, they encounter a beautiful woman, played by January Jones from Mad Men, and Phil immediately regrets getting married. The three of them decide to have dinner. And Phil, in an effort to look more appealing to the new woman, decides to shave off his long, wild beard. Kristen Schaal's character is surprised by his new look.
Phil Miller, what's gotten into you?
I don't know what you're talking about, Carol. Just coming down for dinner, as I do.
So you got rid of the beard?
Yes, I did.
Oh, that was kind of cool.
You did? Oh.
Yeah. Your chin is too pointy. You just need something to smooth it out.
You feel the same way about
it? You look smaller.
Weaker.
Okay.
Who do you look like?
Quentin Tarantino.
Okay. Yeah. I don't see that.
Katie Lang.
Oh, Katie. It's Katie Lang.
Isn't it?
Katie Lang, the female country singer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I like it.
Well, you don't have to look at it.
I guess I don't. Shall we eat?
That's a scene from The Last Man on Earth. Will Forte, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Can you talk about filming that scene? Because you had just shaved off this beard that you've had for a really long time.
I had just shaved the beard off. I had been living with this beard for about 9 months, and I had a real love-hate relationship with it. There are a lot of very tricky things when you have a beard of that size. Eating is horrible. Personal interactions get tricky, you know, so... People are nervous around a person with a beard that size. But I also kind of missed it. It was like a little security blanket.
So you wrote the whole premise for this show in a weekend, this idea of a post-apocalyptic comedy. It's a funny premise because what happens is first there's Phil alone and then a woman shows up and it's just these few people. First the two of you, then three, then four. But still all of the same issues sort of come up. You know, there's jealousy, there's, you know, trying to figure out what the right thing to do is.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, eventually the show becomes more than just just sex stuff and procreation and repopulation, but this seemed like a fun territory to start. The other interesting thing to us was, you know, taking the characters in different directions. Like, you know, you automatically in the first episode, you want your character to be likable. You want people to find him to be sympathetic. And then, you know, we thought it would be interesting to move away from there and create this character who isn't the perfect person. You know, in this show, I feel like if you continue to watch, your allegiances will kind of constantly be shifting.
Now, people know you primarily from being a performer, from being a cast member on SNL and being an actor, but your first job in comedy was as a comedy writer. Is that right?
Yep.
Is that right? And you're also a member of the improv group, The Groundlings.
Yep.
And I think while you were writing for That 70s Show, you were discovered by Lorne Michaels while you're performing at one of the Groundling shows. Can you tell us that story?
I just lucked out, and Lorne Michaels came to one of the shows, and I already had a job, so I didn't even think that it was possible to go over to SNL. I was under contract with Carsey Werner and the 70s Show, so I was nice and loose because I was very happy as a comedy writer too. So I just didn't even think that it was an option. And then I ended up having a good night probably because I was so loose. And he invited me for an audition, and I was terrified. I had to really get talked into auditioning. And then I went out, auditioned, and got the job, and then turned it down, just terrified that I wouldn't be good at it. And I would be giving up this amazing job at 70s Show, which was such a fun job, great people. I liked the show so much, and I turned it down, and I regretted it for the entire year that I had to wait until Lauren, thank God, came back the next year and asked me if I would change my mind, and I decided I had to go for it because I just would never forgive myself if I didn't at least see what it would be like.
So a lot of people know you for your comedic roles, but I think a lot of people discovered you as a dramatic actor when you did your role in the Alexander Payne film Nebraska. Let's hear a scene from the film. Woody, the father, played by Bruce Dern, thinks he's won $1 million, but it's a scam. It's one of those scam sweepstakes. But he's convinced you, his younger son, David, to drive him from Billings, where they live, to Lincoln, Nebraska. And on the way, you've stopped at the hometown, his hometown, where he grew up. And you are in a local bar there. You've had some drinks, and you're trying to connect with him. That's one of the reasons why you've taken him on this trip. Let's take a listen.
I didn't tell you that Noelle and I broke up.
Who?
Noelle? You're the girl I've been living with for the past 2 years? She moved out. We broke up. Maybe I should have asked her to get married. I don't know. I just never felt sure, you know what I mean? I mean, how are you supposed to know when you're sure? Are you sure?
Huh?
How did you and Mom end up getting married?
She wanted to.
You didn't?
Well, I figured what the hell.
Were you ever sorry you married her?
All the time. Could have been worse.
Well, you must have been in love. At least at first.
Never came up.
Did you ever talk about having kids? How many you wanted and stuff like that?
Nope.
And why did you have us?
Because I like this. And your mother's a Catholic, so you figure it out.
So you and Mom never actually talked about whether you wanted kids or not?
Well, I figured if we kept on s***ing, we'd end up with a couple of you.
That's a scene from the film Nebraska with Bruce Dern and our guest, Will Forte. Bruce Dern has said that during some of the filming of the movie Nebraska, he took out his hearing aids because he is a person who's kind of very present. And to help him connect to the character Woody, who's a little bit more removed, he took out his hearing aids. And you sort of get that here when he's doing all the what while you guys are yeah. talking. Also, you drove with Bruce Dern, I think, part of the route from Billings, Montana to Nebraska. Can you talk about spending that much time with Bruce Dern and if you sort of spent time as yourselves or kind of in character?
We spent a ton of time together. It was pretty amazing to watch him make the transformation because for anybody who doesn't know him, he's the most vibrant, feisty in a fun way. He's just awesome and full of life. And then the moment that the cameras would start rolling, he just morphed into the Woody character. It's about as drastically different as you can get. And no, we didn't spend, you know, the moments we would be done shooting or between takes, you know, we wouldn't be in character. We'd just be talking like friends. I mean, that was such a big part of this experience because I was really nervous the whole way through. I was, you know, I didn't want to mess up Alexander Payne's movie and Bruce Dern's movie. Here are all these legendary people. And he was so good about putting me at ease that friendship that we developed helped me get out of my head and I think do a better job in the movie. And yeah, the very end, after we completed all the dialogue stuff from the movie, we actually went to Billings, Montana and made the trip all the way to northern Nebraska. And Alexander Payne followed us in this big RV. He actually had bought the RV that Jack Nicholson drives around in About Schmidt. So he had this RV, and they mounted a camera to the front of it and would just drive behind us and then pull up to the side of us and get all these just amazing shots of that drive. But the whole time, Bruce and I are in this car just for days and days just talking about life, and I could listen to his stories forever. He's a fascinating, wonderful man.
Will Forte, thank you for coming on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me on Fresh Air.
Will Forte, speaking with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado. Forte created and stars in the Fox comedy series The Last Man on Earth. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.